All right. Hey there, everybody. This is Kevin Briggs. I'm really happy that you're tuning in, listening to the Seeds of Liberation podcast. This is episode number 5 right here on the wonderful Anchor app. And this podcast episode is all about eating. I wanted to maybe call it the ethical eating episode, but I would be infringing on a friend of mine's idea that already exists, which I'm going to also tell you all about. So anyway, thanks so much for being here. Thanks again to Anchor for having such a great platform to do this on. And thanks also to Josh Crandall's wonderful new podcast, The Ethical Eater, which everybody should check out, and which I'm also looking forward to being a guest on tomorrow, where Josh and I will talk about different topics really surrounding ethical eating and really something kind of cool is going to be from two different perspectives. Josh is a homesteader, and he raises his own cattle essentially and gets into raising animals and caring for them in the way that they are going to be then most healthy to eat when it comes time to do so, and raises bees and gets into all kinds of things like that. And I am definitely vegetarian. I would say I'm close to vegan, but I just am not quite intense enough about it to fully say that, I think. Either way, it's going to be a great episode from two people who have a whole lot of respect for each other, talking about similarities and differences regarding their views around eating. Pardon me, I shifted the microphone so it would be more centrally located in front of my face. I noticed in the last, or a little bit of early recording I was doing, it was clipping out a little bit. So a podcast episode on ethical eating, this could go a lot of different ways. And I think for me, the best approach is just to approach it from my personal standpoint. When I say it, I mean eating and this concept of ethical eating. And the reason why ethical eating comes into it is because that's something that I feel that I'm interested in, at least. I'm definitely attempting to put it into practice in some way. But to talk about eating is like to talk about breathing. So it's this essential human endeavor, this thing that we have to do. Some people throughout history have found ways to eat very minimally. Some people certainly have found ways to eat a great deal. But what's true is that we require some kind of consumption of nutrients or things that contain nutrients in order to continue to live. Even if that means you're a sun eater over in India and you don't really even consume solid food. Excuse me. But it's this essential thing, and we all share it, not only humans, but I would venture to say every living organism consumes in order to survive. And certainly we as humans do. And it seems to be the case that we as humans have greater power to choose based on maybe more complex ideas than other species have. I don't really know the science around that, but it seems like it would make sense. But anyway, so it's this essential activity. There's certainly a physicality to eating. When we talk about amounts of food that we have, we talk about different ingredients or even materials, if you will, that are in foods. And when we eat them, things happen to our physical body. In a way that, in kind of a contained way, really. Certainly, the way we feel changes. We also have maybe are not feeling not as hungry anymore. So there's a physical difference in what's happening in our stomach and our digestive system. You know, maybe we're tired after we eat. Maybe we've had too much of one thing and not enough of some other thing. Maybe we need more fluids. That's kind of thing is physicality, where you can look at it all from a really Western scientific perspective and break it up into its parts and say, here's what it is to have and consume and process food. So that can happen, and that's certainly going on everywhere. That is not something that I have all kinds of details about. I think I'm living more in the land of theoretical approaches to eating, where the physicality of eating is only one component. There are other considerations, and that's something that we'll get into. Because even though there's this physicality, even though different types of ingredients can be broken down in different parts until we can say this is exactly, you know, physically speaking, this is exactly what composes this thing. You know, it's made out of this. It has chlorophyll, and that's why it's green. You know, it has whatever other parts of a living organism there are. We can break that apart. And sorry for the pause there. I had to divert my attention there for a second, but we can break it apart and we can look at all those things. And then we can also draw people's blood and say, here's what's happening with blood sugars. And we can do all these physical things. But it just seems like there's something else about it. And when I talk about, and I don't claim to really know what that is. But, you know, the Buddhists a few thousand years ago, like close to 3, hypothesized that, first they hypothesized that all things were essentially composed of what seemed to be space. And that's something that's maintained today in the West. It was just kind of discovered in a different way. But it's the same idea. The Buddhists then took it one step further to claim that there was in fact no space, that even when it appears there's space, it's still physical matter that can be, I guess, divided up and looked at. No matter how powerful you want to make your microscope, you can just keep looking and looking and looking. Even when things seem to break apart, it's just that we don't have the capability to see that thing. But there's not like an end point to nature or physical existence. Matter continues. And so it's that kind of idea. But then what binds it? What animates it? And I know there are a lot of theories that I'm not real versed on that have to do with physics and that kind of thing that I think would suggest it. And I think those things are true. And although physics is amazing and I am enthralled by it, really, my main introduction to it was the Dalai Lama's book, The Universe in a Single Atom, where he talks all about his kind of layman's appreciation for physics. But even as great as physics is, and any of the sciences in that way that are looking to measure things, there's a limitation to that. There's something else that is going on with existence. And so that flows over into eating. And so I appreciate you hanging in with my diatribe there, but that flows over into eating. And there's something about it that it doesn't impact our physicality. But there's more than that. It's like one component of it, if you want to chop it into different parts. But there is that physicality aspect and much, much more. Before getting any further into the podcast episode here about ethical eating on the Seeds of Liberation podcast, it's episode number 5, by the way, very exciting. Before getting any further on in this episode, I just want to make sure I make the connection between ethical eating and liberation. I mean, this podcast is all about liberating ourselves, or the things that liberate us, I guess, or ways to experience liberation. So I think ethical eating is very closely linked to it, because what ethical eating is having some knowledge about what you're eating and having some reasons about why you think that's a good idea. And doing it in a way that I think maybe causes the least amount of harm seems to be part of it. And I think that's true. I definitely think that's an aspect of veganism, vegetarianism, and ethical meat eaters are interested in causing the least amount of suffering as possible. So I think those are all parts of it. And so taking that approach has a liberating effect, because if you know more about what you're eating and you have your reasons why you're doing it, then you're less able to be marketed to and manipulated by the big agriculture industry, big pharma, the beef industry, the milk industry, the pork industry. All these are industries. These are for-profit businesses that are interested in selling these meat to people for them to consume. But really, so they make all this money. And so it's a business is what it is. The consumers are people who eat their product. And I'm sure, you know, I don't want to leave veganism, the vegan industry, out of it. It hasn't really been around long enough to have any full-blown scandals, but I'm sure there are some ugly aspects of the industry. It's already, the last I saw, which was last year, it was at that time about a $2 billion industry. And so there's serious money involved in the vegan industry. And with serious money, more problems. More money, more problems. I hope not, but could be the case. Anyway, so to have knowledge about what you're eating and have reasons why you think it's the right thing to do, like the right thing to eat for you or even for others, but having that knowledge, then being reflective about that knowledge, and then choosing the best thing for you is the liberating thing, because the milk, it does a body good. Beef, it's what's for dinner. There's all these pork, the other white meat, which is kind of like a compliment to chicken. It's suggesting that pork is the often forgotten about white meat that's actually pretty good, but you didn't really even know it was white meat, and everybody likes chicken, right? Well, this is like more like chicken, so you should like it maybe as much as chicken or something like that. But anyway, these are all advertisements. These are all, they just want you to buy and they want you to consume. And then it opens up this whole consideration into what that means for other industries like the health industry and certainly big pharma and those kinds of organizations. So to be liberated from all that, to be knowing what we're eating and having deeply held understandings and maybe awareness of why we think that's a good idea is how this relates to liberation. Hey, I want to thank everybody for tuning in once again. This is really a topic of high interest of mine, ethical eating. Very happy to talk about it. I'm definitely looking forward to talking with my good friend, Josh Crandall over there by Philadelphia, about ethical eating as well. And that is the name of his entire podcast, is the Ethical Eating Podcast. Josh is super into doing what he feels, approaching his food in a way that he feels is ethical. I find him very reflective about it, passionate about it as well. And it's just going to be a great talk from two people who have, as I mentioned earlier, some divergent views on the types of foods that we think are the right ones to eat, I guess. But I have full confidence that Josh is 110% going for the ethics in his approach. I would be remiss to say regarding how ethical eating is liberating. I would be remiss to talk about the physicality of it. And as this physicality, as I mentioned earlier, which I think is related to other areas and which I'll also get into. But when you eat in a way, the other liberating aspect of it is when you eat with intentionality for reasons that you think are the best choice for you and the world around you, then that's also liberating. You also feel good when you eat that food. It's not like going to something I used to do when I was a kid. I mean, by kid, I mean like junior or senior in college, and I was loving Chinese food, and I would get like the whole triple delight with garlic sauce, and I would eat the whole entire thing plus like two egg rolls. And I would watch TV while I ate it. And I love the taste of that food. I still love the taste of that food. The sauce in particular, I mean, it's just like, how can anybody have anything bad to say about brown garlic sauce from a Chinese restaurant? But that's what they cook it in. And, but I just used to eat it mindlessly, and I would be completely stuffed afterwards, where I had to like lay on the couch for 20 minutes or something while my body processed this onslaught of heavy foods that I just put into it. So that's, there's no liberation going on in that scene right there that I just described. That's a gorging, that's a mindless eating practice. And that is honestly physical discomfort and doing harm to your body because of what you chose to eat and how you chose to eat it. And my reason why for eating that kind of food was that I thought it tasted really good. And I got all this comfort out of watching Philadelphia Eagles football, Donovan McNabb, Andy Reid era, Brian Westbrook. I would love to just eat it during the first half of the game. And then I knew I'd be super stuffed, but I also knew I scheduled that time to like just sit there and watch the game. And it was like this ritual, this like watch sports and gorge myself routine. So that there's no liberation going on with that kind of eating. It just feels good for like 10 or 15 minutes when you're really hungry and you're eating it. But then everything, it's all downhill after that. The point is to eat in a more mindful way, a more knowledge-based way that's a result of reflecting on what the best choices are for you, also results in more physical comfort. Your digestion, just because of it, I would say, regardless of what you're even choosing to eat at that point, if you're approaching it with that mindset, with that intentionality, your digestion's gonna be better. You're eating from this really internally sound perspective, whatever it is you're putting in your mouth. That's a healthy place to be. Whether your choices are healthy is another issue. So that would be something to talk about too. But so it's liberating to eat in a mindful way is really what the bottom line is. One thing I wanted to make sure I mentioned is that I'm doing this recording outside right now on my AT2020 Audio Technica microphone. Great mic. USB mic plugs right into the laptop, makes things really easy. It sounds crystal clear. In fact, though, it's really sensitive, so I'm assuming that all these sounds that are around us right now, I should say around me right now, are coming into the mic. So if you hear any random sounds or anything like that, it's because I'm outside, and I kind of think it brings a more accessible appeal to it or something. Instead of, I would like to use all kinds of different music, and I have all sort of ideas for that. I'm still sorting out the technology on it, and I don't want to have to deal with using any copyrighted music. So I can also play some of my own, and I also have some of my own that I could use with also permission from the Feats of Strength. But I have some specific things that like I have on my mind where I could even dash in little clips here and there. But I just don't quite know how to do that yet. So anyway, if you hear any sounds, it's because I'm outside on my back porch. Excuse me. So I would like to thank Josh Crandall for inspiring me to talk about this in this podcast episode. Josh is the founder and the on-air talent for the Ethical Eating Podcast. It's his podcast where he talks all about his journey of ethical eating. And that's one thing I really like about Josh is he views what he's doing as an unfolding. He hasn't arrived in a spot and said, and dug his heels in and stood there and said, this is the best way to do eating. And this is what I'm going to be advocating for in sort of this blind, really partisan way. He's not like that at all. In fact, he views it as a journey. And so he has this wonderful podcast where he talks about the types of his background and the types of things he's doing to be an ethical eater. And it's just really great. It's one of my favorite ones to listen to. We're going to be on together an episode that we're recording tomorrow. I'm not quite sure when it'll be published. I would assume by tomorrow night. But I'll be blasting that out on social media, just like this. So usually on my Facebook site, which is, you just look up Kevin Briggs at Facebook, and that's me. There also on Instagram, Seeds of Liberation on Instagram. And so there's some of that. Now, as far as Josh goes, excuse me, it's really a great relationship. And in fact, the two of us were just talking about it today. We were talking about some of the stuff that we're going to get into when we record the episode. And I think there, it wasn't a feeling out because we know each other well enough where there didn't need to be really much of that. But there was a little bit of like, okay, I know this is going to go well. What position are, you know, where are you positioned on these topics? And here's where I'm at with those. Just so you know, I'll be talking from that point of view. It was like that kind of stuff. And what struck me about it was it's just a really harmonious type of communication that, quite frankly, I can say that I just don't have with all kinds of people all over the place. Certainly, Sonia and I have that kind of communication often with kids and friends, but it's a rarity to have a real just harmonious communication, especially with a person who's on, like, as I was saying earlier, on a little bit of a different path in terms of what may or may not be ethical. But it's just like there's this commonality where that has something to do with our intentions. And I'd be interested in exploring whatever that is in actually a different episode and how that can liberate us to understand what these things are that attract us to each other. But as far as Josh goes, I've just really enjoyed being able to talk with, excuse me, I don't know if avid meat eater is the right way of putting it, but just regular meat eater, meat that he raises, meat that he, from animals that he raises, that he cares for, that he does his best to ensure the health of. And so it's great to be able to listen to him and have a deeper understanding of him and honestly a deeper appreciation for what his choices are. This takes us to the segment, I think, where it's best for me to sort of flesh out where I stand on eating. And so I can break it down into essentially three categories. And I'm not much of a categories person. I'm really not a linear or sequential thinker most of the time. I'm pretty abstract random. And when I'm not random, I'm still pretty abstract, abstract sequential. I don't know, whatever these labels are. But it does help, I think, for understanding and for a podcast episode to kind of break things down a little bit. So the breakdown is, my ideas around eating and ethical eating have to do with physical considerations, spiritual considerations, and intellectual or cognitive considerations, and not in that order. In fact, I made a note and I didn't pay attention to the note when I was speaking, but I would even kind of rank them. First would actually be spiritual considerations. Second would be physical considerations for sure. And then third are the cognitive considerations. And I'll get into talking about each one I already really went over the physicality of eating and what my thoughts were about that. And so that's the realm that I'm going to talk about when I talk about the physicality. The one I want to start out off with is the spiritual considerations. So I guess full disclosure, I consider myself Buddhist. About 90% or maybe higher, if I could sort of state it that way, because the ethical teachings in Buddhism from the Pali scriptures, the oldest existing complete set of early scriptures from early Buddhism, like the ethical teachings, 100%. I can't figure out why any of that's wrong. So I agree with that. I agree that the practices that are taught in the Pali scriptures are conducive to people living happier lives where they make a positive impact on themselves and others. There are some, what I would say, cosmological considerations that I don't quite internalize, I should say. I can intellectually wrap my mind around it and even lean in that direction, but I haven't internalized some of those things. And it's because every once in a while in those scriptures, the Buddha gives a teaching on something that has kind of been shown not to be true anymore. For example, he once speculated about, not really speculated, I mean, he felt he knew, but he once taught about what's going on in a woman's body when she's pregnant. And he was pretty close without having any cameras or, you know, any way to go, any ability to look in ultrasounds, none of that stuff. But he ultimately was not really knowing what was going on. And I think understandably so. So there's parts of Buddhism that every once in a while I'm like, you know, that's not my thing. But I would say by and large, I would feel comfortable claiming to be a Buddhist. And without getting any more into Buddhism, I'll just say, other than this last thing, I'll just say one of the core facets of Buddhism is not causing suffering to others, which includes killing. And others are not just people, it's all sentient beings. So anything that's characterized as being alive, essentially, we're not to harm that thing. So that's the main spiritual consideration. There are a few others, which I think I'll talk about too. But for this first one, I had some kind of, I guess, spiritual awakening when I was in my early 20s, and I walked into a Borders bookstore, not Barnes & Noble's, it was Borders. And I walked into the spirituality section, and I saw Steve Hagen's book, Buddhism Plain and Simple. And I bought that book that day, read it, and I felt like every word in the book was true. And so it sent me on this big reading process and this studying really for about 10 years in Buddhism before I eventually went somewhere to talk to other people about it, which was the Pittsburgh Buddhist Center, where I befriended Bhante Pemarattana, the lead abbot at the center, and he's been just a wonderful teacher, and it's a truly wonderful place that's in a consistent effort of putting their best foot forward to make a positive impact on their life and the world around them. So when all that started happening, I started developing, when I got this interest and read about it, I started developing some thoughts about what I did and did not want to eat. And so I guess in a sense I had some kind of knowledge, and the knowledge was a spiritual and really ethical teaching from Buddhism. And then I reflected on that, and And what I was starting to do is I was just starting to think about the life of the creature that I was eating. Like I would be eating a steak or even a hamburger, and I would sort of have these visualizations of like what part of the body of the cow that it was from. And then that led to other kind of morbid thoughts about the animal and the process of the animal being slaughtered. And in and as a matter of fact, in Buddhism, there's also a practice called the death meditation. And what it is, it's I think more so designed for a person to focus on their own death and what that involves physically with the corpse, essentially. So then you can have a better perspective on the thing that is currently causing you some suffering right now in the present moment, because it just helps the teaching on impermanence, the impermanence of all of our highs and lows in life. But anyway, so I started thinking a lot more about it. And, you know, when I really changed about my eating, I'm not sure exactly what age it was or how long it was after reading about, after how long I had been reading about Buddhism, but I'm pretty sure it was in my mid to late 20s. And one thing that I always really liked to do the whole time growing up is my grandparents lived in Florida, and they had a really beautiful house right on a really beautiful bay on Marco Island. They built that house when it was initially getting developed. And of course, Marco Island is now this big destination for a lot of people. But it was like a home that they had built there way back in the early 70s, I believe. And we fished all the time. We would catch the fish. We'd clean them that day. We'd eat them that night. And we went there once, sometimes twice a year, depending on how work was going with the folks. So I grew up as a fisherman in that way. And then it has extended into adulthood because my parents now own a place there as well, that the family no longer owns that other house. And so my dad has kept up that culture. He loves to fish. You go down there, he wants to take you out to fish. You know, he thinks all about it. He's got all kinds of little spots he wants to go to. And I think he feels real good about driving his family around in his boat to go to show them stuff that he cares so much about. But back in my mid to late 20s, I found myself catching those fish and not wanting them to be in the boat with us. Like I didn't want to take them with us because they were going to die. That's a thought I had. And I kept it to myself because I just didn't want to make my dad feel uncomfortable or for him to think I'd fallen off the deep end or something. Cause I think that's what he would have thought if I said that. But that's how I felt. And then that started extending into the bait that we were using. And this is now a period of over months and years as this evolved for me to eventually, now I have a tentative trip to go back down there with my family this fall, as long as travel is allowed and all that kind of thing. And one thing I really don't want to do is fish, because I don't want to hook a shrimp through its brain or its head anyway, or hook a fish through its chin up through its forehead or its nose, or and like throw it in and hope a bigger fish eats it. I just don't want to do it. And so the point of explaining that is I had this sort of evolving, this slowly evolving change that occurred in terms of what my perspective was about eating meat and I guess killing living beings to do so. Now, I will say that did not change my behavior much. It was just something that I was thinking. And honestly, I was feeling pretty deeply about it. I mean, it really mattered to me. But I was just didn't come from that kind of background. I came from a long line of consistent meat eaters who believe, you know, honestly, a lot of Republican voters in the family. And I only bring that up to say that they are happy to support big businesses like the ag industry and that kind of thing. And certainly, I think maybe at least are characteristically more prone to be the meat eaters. is how it's panned out in my life anecdotally with people I know. But anyway, so it wasn't, and I was honestly in a marriage at the time that I'm no longer in, but it wasn't supported in that household either, nor on that person's side of the family. And so I was sort of on my own with it all. And I didn't know, you know, I'm here in central Pennsylvania, maybe Lancaster area, Erie area, Punxsutawney area. And especially when I was looking into that, which was like the early 2000s, it wasn't something that was very common in central Western or South, well, more so in Lancaster, I guess, but not really. So the veganism and this whole boom is really, I would say, past 10 years or so, if that is when it all really blew up. So even back when I was in my mid to late 20s, it wasn't like this really reliable option to claim to be a vegetarian or something and then go around to people's places, at least not where I was living. Anyway, so I started developing those ideas about not wanting to harm other animals. Also, what goes with the spirit or other living beings, I should say. Also, what goes with the spiritual component. But actually, before I get into that, I want to make a comment, I think, about plants. Because plants are also living, right? I mean, they're characterized by life. They have a conception period, an incubation period, and then they grow and consume and have a whole very complex structure as a living organism. So why does that not count the same, right? And I think, at least from a Buddhist perspective, I think there is a premium on the word sentient. And sentient would refer to a living being that appears to have the ability to recognize its suffering. So even bugs, if, you know, a spider loses a leg or, you know, if ants realize there's some kind of danger, they're all scampering around out of fear and anxiety. So I don't know if it's possible to ascertain that the same way through plants, although I do know that there is a lot of theoretical kind of stuff that exists and is continuing to emerge. And I would have to imagine empirical studies that are designed to look at what life maybe means for plants. And plants are able to communicate with each other in ways to ward off infections and trees in the root systems can sort of alert each other to when there's a tree has some kind of disease or problem, that kind of thing. But anyway, so I recognize that's the case. But as of now, at least to my knowledge, there's no indication that the plants are like suffering when they're harvested and cooked. But anyway, the other aspect of the spiritual consideration has to do with the quality of what we're eating. And I don't mean grade A Black Angus versus Walmart's ground beef or something like that, some super heady organic grass-fed private farm versus the worst ever big ag meat market. I suppose maybe it is connected to that, but I mean the quality of the meat that is reflecting what the life of the animal was like. Because you can see it in the animals. If you lined up a series of cows, and one of the cows was from a basically cow factory where thousands of cows were being raised as quickly as possible so they could grow to full size, reproduce, produce their milk, you know, without any breaks from their fertile period, all these things that go on over there. You can, if you took that cow and stood it, you know, right in front of you, and then you took a cow from a local farm here, right here in Center County that raises cattle, where they only ever have a handful of cows, maybe not even a dozen, maybe not even 10. I don't know. Just a few cows that essentially have open rein in a really widely fenced area. And by widely fenced, I mean like acres of land to roam. And we're, you know, we are talking about a cow, so they're not the most active, like agile creatures in the world, but it's plenty of land to roam, plenty of nice fresh water, plenty of fresh grass and other foods that they're giving them. They get time to be outside. They get the time to be with each other. They're cared for by veterinarians in whatever ways that's helpful. If you stand that cow up next to the factory farm cow, it's going to look like a different animal, or at least two very different cows. And you can also see it with chickens, the way they're raised. And so there's something about the environment that the animals are raised in. And there's also something about what they're fed. So if you have, Thich Nhat Hanh made the greatest point, and I'll never forget reading it for the first time. I believe it was in his book, The Miracle of Mindfulness. Right in the beginning, he starts out a lot of his books with a section on mindful eating and what it means to really pay attention to and chew your food and the impact that that has on the physiology of our digestive systems. And Thich Nhat Hanh had this way of saying about chickens that were cooped up in factory farms that are all shoved in cages together, sometimes with their beaks cut off so they don't peck each other. And then they live these horrible 36-day lives or whatever amount of time it takes to grow a chick into a full-grown chicken with steroids and that kind of thing. And by the time, and they live these horrible lives, really, of extreme discomfort, kind of torture, really, and complete lack of health. That is going to have an impact on the quality of the meat. I think it can be as simple as, again, the physicality, saying, okay, this is tough meat, or this doesn't taste as good as this other one, or something like that. But that's just all on the surface. The reason it is so impacted by this negative environment is because there are physiological changes that are going on due to that environment. And so again, we get into this debate of how far can we break that down? Like, how can we look at all these different parts, all these different considerations? But one thing's for sure, a life of physical discomfort, fear, and anxiety leads to something, a product, an animal, that when it's dead and you cook it, tastes different than one that's been hugged its whole life, right? I think that's true. I mean, even if you put those animals next to each other, you would see a difference. If you go into the grocery store and you buy the cheapest piece of chicken you can buy, then you go to a local farmer's market and buy the meat from a chicken that they, you know, slaughtered by themselves that week, it's gonna taste different. I would say that it's gonna taste different even if they eat the exact same kind of food, because there's some kind of energetic impact on the animal. And so that's the other spiritual consideration, is this, is what you're eating. And Thich Nhat Hanh called it eating anxiety. So if you eat the, but going back to the chickens, if you eat, those chickens live a life of fear, discomfort, anger, anxiety. And so whatever that animal experienced throughout its life gets internalized into its cells. And then we eat that thing, and then that is in us. Okay, and I think even on, from a skeptical, I think even from a skeptical standpoint, even if you're like, well, or if somebody, or I am like, well, I guess so. I mean, sure, it tastes different, but it's like a harder life and everything's, you know, all firmed up and it's just the way it is, you know, but sure, it tastes different, but no big deal. I don't know. It seems to me to be a big deal. I don't think that can be denied. So that's the other spiritual component. Now, moving on, there's the physicality, and really, I've spoken a little bit about that already for this episode, but the other thing I'll say, I'm trying to say what my positionality is. So I have this positionality of a spiritual consideration, a physical consideration, and a cognitive consideration. The spiritual consideration is what I just finished talking about for 20 minutes or so. And then now I want to talk about the physical consideration. And this goes back to about the year 2011, I would say. And I had been on my Buddhist path for about 10 years at that point. That's right around the time when I was thinking about, when I was seeking out a Buddhist teacher, and right around the time that I found Pittsburgh Buddhist Center. And what happened was I started getting sick with diverticulitis. It went on for, the first time it ever happened, I just thought I had a stomach ache because I ate half a pizza and drank a six pack the night before. And I was like, yeah, of course I have a stomach ache. But it didn't go away. And there was actually a serious problem. And so when I went in to get diagnosed, I went to the emergency room. I was in there for like 7 hours. And finally, I was 32, so they thought they weren't considering diverticulitis or diverticulosis. But they admitted me. So then I was in the hospital for about 4 days taking the antibiotics to cure the infection. And then it came back 3 more times within 2 years. So if you have it twice within a year, you're considered a candidate for surgery. So by the time I was 34, I guess, I kept getting diverticulitis, and it was dominating my eating choices because everything I ate, I was just trying not to have it hurt in my colon, essentially, because you could feel, it was very sensitive and it would flare up if I just ate one wrong thing. And I don't know exactly what the science is. And I don't think there is science about why that's the case, but that was what was happening. So I opted to get the surgery where they removed it. And the whole descending colon and sigmoid colon, and they removed all the major outbreaks of the diverticulitis. And when that was happening, the first time I went into the hospital, I had never been sick before. I really never had to go to the hospital as an adult for like an illness. So I was a little scared. And I was thinking, there's got to be something that changes. Like, I have to get serious about this. What if I don't know what this is. What if I died? Then all I'll have to say for myself is that I read about Buddhism for 10 years, and I have this really strong feeling about it, of this thing that I think explains all of existence. But I never really even went to talk to anybody about it. So, like, I didn't benefit in the way that I best could from it. So I decided right there and then to be more serious about my spiritual interests. But I also decided, and that part of that included eating in a way that Buddhism maintained was ethical, which excluded meat. So with that spiritual component in place, I started moving away from eating meat. And it all, the way, when I knew that I was changing about my attitude towards eating meat was on a trip to Florida to see my parents when I was in my mid to late 20s. And we would go down there to visit, and I was doing it ever since I was a kid. My grandparents had a place down there. My parents now have a place down there. And we grew up fishing. We would go there, and a couple weeks out of the year, if we were lucky, we could get down there and we would fish every day. And we were catching all kinds of stuff. We'd fish with live shrimp. We'd throw them in for red snapper, all that kind of stuff. And I knew that my attitude about it all was changing because I went down there to fish, and I didn't want to keep the fish that we had caught. I didn't want to put them in the fish containment area of the boat or whatever, because I didn't want to kill it. And then that's flow over. ensuing visits down there, it flowed into not wanting to bait the shrimp or like sardines up through the bottom of their mouth or anything like that, because I didn't want to hurt the things. I didn't want to like be hooking something through its face, you know, or putting a hook through a shrimp's like head in a way where I can just avoid the brain, those kinds of things. And I just didn't want to take the life. So that's when I knew that I was feeling differently about eating sentient beings, like fish as a sentient being. Other spiritual considerations include Thich Nhat Hanh's concept of eating anger or eating anxiety, whatever the quality of the life was like for the animal, impacts the physicality of the animal and impacts the essence of the animal's meat. So whatever, if they lived a life of anxiety and fear, locked in a cage on top of another of five other chickens with their beaks cut off, that's going to be transferable into its body on a molecular level, if nothing else, but also on an energetic level. And so then when we eat that animal, we eat the impact that that torturous existence had on the physicality and the energetic aspect of the animal. So that would also be something that we don't want to do. Physically, I want to say that I am someone who at 32 started getting repeated instances of diverticulitis, and it had a profound effect on me, especially the first time I got it, and then when I had the surgery to remove it. I contemplated for the first time at 32 laying in a hospital bed being treated for it, what life after death, because I wasn't sure what I had. I had never heard of it, and I wasn't sure what the prognosis was. So I started thinking a little bit about death, and I realized that I didn't really have much of an understanding. Like, if I was going to die, I realized that I did not have a healthy understanding of what that meant. Like, I didn't have any concept of it other than I didn't know what was going to happen, and eventually, like, I'd be gone or something. So that scared me the most. And so I just decided to be more serious about my Buddhist pursuits, which got me a little more serious about the idea of eating meat or not, and also dairy products was a consideration of mine. But from a physical standpoint, it's all about fiber when you start having that kind of digestive issue. And so I just did not want to eat anything that didn't have a significant or at least a healthy amount of fiber in it, because I wanted my digestion to be as smooth as possible. So meat and cheese and dairy products don't have fiber in them. So it was, from a physical standpoint, it was like, I'm not going to eat that food because I've had this problem, which is probably due to a low fiber diet. It's a Western diet problem, meaning like Americans and Europeans and North Americans tend to get diverticulitis, not people in countries where they eat more whole foods. And so that physical component, you know, I decided to get more serious about it. And more simply than that, I noticed that the more I didn't eat meat or dairy, the better I felt when I was done eating, and the better I felt kind of throughout the day. You didn't have peaks and valleys of energy that like eating a hamburger and also maybe eating like a side of fries, or let's just say the hamburger, or let's just even say a really high-end steak. There's something about it. It's harder for your body to digest. It doesn't have any fiber in it, like I mentioned. And it's a big, thick thing to work its way through your system. So it's harder on it than eating fruits and vegetables or plant-based things. So I just knew that I felt better when I didn't eat it. On a very simple level. And I hadn't quite bridged the gap between my spiritual leanings and that the realization of the physicality. But I'm working on it, or I was working on it. I still am. The last consideration is what I would say the cognitive consideration. And this just means ideas, or even the growing knowledge base about the way food impacts our health. Or even theories or philosophical sort of propositions about food. So these are things, though, that for me, maybe I don't quite know about. So they're like cognitive considerations. It's like they're ideas that have some sense to them and seem to have something to them. But like, I really don't know. And so, like, for example, the impact that the factory farming has on the environment. I think there have been studies that have been shown that factory farms have a more negative impact on the environment than all the car exhausts from all the cars in the world or something like that. So I know a little bit about that. Like, I've heard that, but I consider it a cognitive consideration because it's, first of all, I don't know that study, what the variables were, what the controls were, and I'd be interested to see how they really, really determined that. So there's like a gap maybe in understanding, and that's why I just say it's a cognitive sort of, it's like an idea to consider. So that's kind of where I'm at with it all. I would say definitely vegetarian with vegan leanings. I do every once in a while try meat. And when I do, I go to a local restaurant we have here in where I live called Otto's, and it's a brewery, but they source all their meat from local farms right here in Center County. And it's the kind of meat that I think is the best to eat. And so because it's family farm meat, there's no factory stuff going on. Those cows are walking around having a nice time, sleeping comfortably and warm and all that kind of stuff. Excuse me. So I do that every once in a while. Sometimes I try eggs because I'm thinking, okay, I think there's maybe like a minimal amount of harm going on. I'm not really sure exactly what's up with the chickens when they do that, but I think it's a relatively natural process. Of course, I would only eat local eggs or the eggs from maybe a neighbor who had chickens in their backyard or something like that. So the chickens are laying healthy numbers of eggs. But by and large, I would say about 90 to 95% vegan / vegetarian. So that's where I am with everything. And I really appreciate being able to share that with you. Going back to my harmonious communication with Josh, the founder of the Ethical Eater podcast, which I'll be on tomorrow. It was really a light bulb moment for me because the way that we are able to communicate with each other, expressing sometimes opposing or very differing views, and we do so in a way where we're intently listening to the other person and really interested in connecting. So we get in a spot where our differences don't matter so much, or at least they don't matter in a way where there's some kind of overwhelming turnoff about the other person's choices. And it's pretty cool because considering the divisiveness in our culture right now, and certainly here in America, things are pretty nuts right now. It's all about people having differences and just seeing things in opposing ways or having different morals or ethics and different approaches to this and that. But really the differences, unless you're into persuading people to see things your way because you think your way is the best way and there's something wrong with their way, unless you think that way, the differences really don't matter. What's important? Is it important? There's a what you're choosing. There's an importance of what you're choosing. But it's also, it's more about why are you making that choice? That's what's most important. And what works for one person doesn't work for another person necessarily. We all have different constitutions. My dad, again, has about a 90% meat-eating diet. And I think that's not even, I think that's still, that number's still a little bit low. He's also diabetic, or at least has pre-diabetes. He controls it pretty well by exercising every day. And then he eats foods that aren't complicated for what's going on with the sugar in our body. So meat is good for that. I mean, I won't say it's good for it, but I will say it doesn't complicate diabetes necessarily. So he eats a lot of meat. And in that sense, that works for his constitution. He also is totally addicted to it, conditioned to think it tastes like the most amazing thing ever. And he's got all of our classic, I think, American conditioning, especially from that baby boomer generation, where meat really took off as this big thing that everybody could have on their dinner table, beef in particular. But so, and you know, there are vegan athletes. There are non-vegan athletes. I remember reading about Brock Lesnar, former UFC champion, and I think as famous for that as he is in the WWE, but just a gigantic fella. I don't know what his stats are, but he's got to be at least like 6'5 or 6'6 and at least 280 pounds. Like, he's this monster guy. And I read a story back when he was champion about him ordering at a restaurant, and he like doubled everything that he ordered. So he got the double chicken dinner, he got the double blah, blah, blah appetizer, the double soup, the double bread. And he just ate all that food. But he's this enormous guy that works out for 4 to 6 hours a day. And he's trying to maximize his muscle mass and all that kind of stuff. And so he's eating in a particular way. And he actually ended up getting diverticulitis and diverticulosis and got the surgery too. And so maybe he eats differently now also. I don't know. But what he was eating was working for him in terms of what his ethics were. And that was, he's a professional athlete. He's trying to be as successful as possible. And he was trying to really be the healthiest that he thought he could be for his body. You know, so there's just all kinds of considerations is really what the thing is. What I find most interesting is a lot of people's lack of interest in talking about diet or seeing the value in somebody else's choice. This is definitely something that Josh and I share. We both have some commonalities from our family backgrounds, and also I would say our social circles, about, you know, we've had difficulties communicating with people in those groups about the way we eat. And so we definitely connect on that point. And really, I think what we share is that we just want to be seen. And it's, even though there's all these differences, it's actually a pretty cool thing to be talking with somebody about something that is so important to you, and they're listening and looking for ways to connect with you on that topic because they also love it. And again, it's something we didn't really have too much of in both of our respective backgrounds and in our current extended family settings. But, you know, but we have this way of connecting because of that. And I will also say, I think it's very important to say, both Josh and I have very supportive life partners, spouses, our wives, who we're ethically and morally aligned with. And so there's a great support system and congruence there. So our homes are sound in terms of what our approaches are, but we connected on this sort of but through this experience of not having anyone to talk to about our interests. So that just kind of gets us, we are getting towards the end here. This has been a relatively long podcast, but I just really overplanned it. So there are a couple other things that I would like to go over. And I think I would like to build a little bit on this this idea that I was talking about people not being interested to discuss divergent views. And it's definitely something that's going on in food conversations. Certainly vegans can be as militant as anybody about what's right and wrong and ethical and unethical and these different things. And certainly meat eaters, people who are super into eating meat on principle almost, can be difficult, and it just varies by person, of course, but it seems that people aren't so much interested in hearing about divergent views. And so because of that, it seems to me that they are then more susceptible to what's going on in big ag and big pharma, and they're more susceptible to being marketed towards and being manipulated because they don't want to have a discussion. They want to absorb the knowledge, but that's it, and just leave it there. And so it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me, but it's honestly at the core of what the issue is around food in the first world, I guess, is that there's all kinds of information about it where you can actually make the decisions that would be best for you. You can figure it out, I think, with relative ease, especially with the internet, but people just don't do that. And so they're just taking whatever they're given. I had a conversation with someone at work a few years ago where I was talking about my decision not to drink milk. And the person was a local Center County person, grew up on a farm and was super into milk and dairy, and was like, well, what do you mean you're not going to drink milk? I'm like, well, there's really no reason to. Like, what's the point? And she's like, well, it's milk. And I was like, okay. I didn't take the conversation any further, but I think the point is clear that because of her conditioning, she just couldn't consider the option of not drinking milk. It's like a staple of the diet or something like that. One thing I would like to point out about some of my experiences with people who weren't interested in discussing ethical eating, essentially, with me. A lot of those experiences definitely have to do with the family that I was raised in, although my mom is a very conscientious cook and is very thoughtful about what she's making. But there was a limit to how much discussion we were even having about food. But in my professional settings as a K-12 teacher, work at a Penn State University as well, you know, I have these just images in my mind of going into the faculty room at the school where I was teaching and a bunch of people sitting around just eating like meatball subs and walking tacos and just drinking a Pepsi, you know, and complaining, which doesn't help either. That was all going on. Over at Penn State, there was definitely a more health conscious approach to work-life balance and that kind of thing. And they had more time on their hands than they do at the school district, even though the Penn State folks tend to think that they're completely overwhelmed and all this kind of thing. The job was nothing compared to working in a public school district. It's so much slower pace in the public school. But the folks there still were not eating well, I would say. I mean, there'd be people sitting around eating, you know, some kind of cheesy tortilla soup, which I'm sure tasted delicious, but they'd be sitting there eating that, like typing on their computer with one hand and putting a spoon in their mouth with the other hand of just essentially like warm cheese and tortillas. And that was all they'd eat for the whole middle of the day. So cheese and bread, essentially, not very nutritious. And there was this whole sort of initiative about counting your steps and doing all that stuff. People used to try to talk me into getting a bracelet to count my steps, Fitbit, I think they're called. But I was at the time I was running a whole lot. I mean, 5, 7, 9 miles a day kind of thing. And so I didn't feel I needed to count my steps. But it's almost like part of the culture as well, as they were very concerned about counting their steps, not real concerned about exercising. You know, where you can go do 20 minutes of rigorous activity and probably surpass whatever those 10,000 steps get you and kickstart your metabolism and all that kind of thing. Or better yet, do both. So it was a really interesting culture over there. regarding that. But the food thing was the same. People were just eating quickly and they were eating what was cheap or what was left over. Leftovers were probably the best food that they ate. But it was like that also. So really interesting. I think what the conversation boils down to is this, a question of what can we do about all of this? And the thing, and it's really a question of control. What can we control in this situation? How can we have an impact? How can we like do something about it? And really, from my perspective, there's only one thing that we can definitely control regarding all of this. And the thing that we can control, as long as we have the means to do so, and I mean financial means, we can control what we put in our mouths. And that's what's true no matter what the case may be, no matter what the reason are you're putting that thing in your mouth, no matter what your beliefs are, Buddhist, Christian, atheist, like Sufi, whatever. You can control as an individual what you choose to eat. And I think even just a few minutes a week spent thinking about the kinds of food that you would prefer to eat for the week or even just in general would have a significant impact on the way we see food. Because think about it, when do you just say to yourself, you know what? I'm going to sit here for the next 5 minutes and all I'm going to do is think about what would be the best things to eat for me. A balance of nutrition, digestibility, taste, availability, cost, like all that kind of stuff, whatever. Whatever you think would be best to put in your body, to spend a little bit of time actually thinking about that. And then really what's been interesting to me, and this has definitely been helpful with different meditation practices where you really start to, it feels like you're starting to see into maybe a little bit of the nature or even the structure of things sometimes, is to think about what I like about food. And so there are a few different considerations. There's taste. Definitely have things that I like the way they taste. I love salsa. I love eating pho, Vietnamese soup, for the broth and the bean sprouts and all that kind of stuff. So I have things that I definitely love to eat because of the taste. So that's a consideration. Nutrition is a consideration as well. Any spiritual things to think about regarding whatever the food is. And then what are some functional considerations about the food? Well, like if I'm an athlete, how is this going to help with my protein, or how's this going to help hydrate me, or whatever? So it became pretty clear to me when I started thinking of food, trying to consider what I actually liked about it, that all of those categories, taste, nutrition, spiritual, and functional, all of those four categories mattered to me kind of the same. I think spiritual is, as it should be, the one that I'm thinking about first, always. I'm like, is there any harm going on here? Or if there is, like, what's the level of harm? But after that, nutrition, the nutritional aspects, which are pretty closely related, it sounds like, to the functional aspects, that's my next consideration. Taste is last. But after it sort of clears my spiritual requirements or whatever they happen to be right there for the moment, then I'm thinking about, okay, now what is good about eating this? Like, where's this food from? Ingredients offer, like how much vitamin C is this onion going to give me, or whatever, some of that kind of thing. And you know, if I'm trying to be more active, how is this going to impact my circulation and how and my amino acids and how I feel about when I'm in mid run? You know, is this going to be good fuel for my body? So I think about those things. And like I said, taste is kind of last these days. What I've done is I've gravitated away from foods that I've labeled unhealthy and or less healthy than other foods, I guess. And then I've gravitated towards more nutritious foods. And then I've figured out ways to like eat more nutritious foods and have them also taste really good, which has a lot to do with cooking at home, by the way. And that's that's another thing to consider that I didn't really prepare any notes on, but I will say one thing about being more mindful or to be more conscientious about what you're eating is you just sort of naturally start cooking at home a little bit more, and you start seeing restaurant menus and even food at other people's houses differently than you saw before, because you all of a sudden have like some sticking points that you're trying to consider about food. So that all helped me a whole lot. And I would say now my kids ask, what's your favorite food? And I'm like, well, my favorite foods are kind of like foods that make me feel good. And they're like, yeah, but like just for taste, like it doesn't have to be good for you. I'm like, I don't really like foods that aren't good for me. I mean, every once in a while I'll eat something horrible, mostly because I think it's going to be a good idea and it turns out to be a terrible idea. So anyway, there's that too. So the last segment I want to get into has to do with what my hope is for this topic, and really any contentious topic or topic that seems to be a source of division in our country right now. My hopes are, first of all, characterized by the fact that I have faith in people. I think people are essentially good. I think it's a core characteristic of what it is to be human is to reduce suffering. That doesn't mean that all people act in that way, because obviously that's not true. I mean, they don't. But somewhere in the heart of it all is a desire to reduce suffering, even if it's in some twisted way to end life will reduce suffering. It's something we share, this inherent goodness that we have. And I have faith in us as people that we can do this. It's like we have the ability to communicate well with each other and be self-reflective and maintain divergent views and live peacefully with each other. We're able to do it, but we are not doing that right now. So it's kind of strange, really. It's not for a lack of ability. It's just for choosing not to for some reason. And I'm not speaking specifically about protesters or people who are Democrats or people who are Republicans or any kind of TV. I'm not speaking about any of that specifically. I'm just saying that people are inherently good and that they can do this. I also think that people can decide for themselves what their views are. They, by being reflective, by considering what their core values are, I think it's for people to decide for themselves. It's not for me or anyone else to tell some other person what to do. What it's for us to do is to be a friend and to encourage and to be a loved one, coworker, just whatever, and to encourage people to be their best. But not to tell them what to do. It really doesn't make any sense. I mean, I think there are instances where people definitely need advice and maybe they need to be told what to do because there's like a situation or there's some kind of thing. But overall, as an ethic, it's not to like this person can't legitimately tell some other person what's best for them or what to do, what decision to make, really. And then the third thing is people just need to find what works for themselves and do it through experimentation. Think about what you're doing. Think about what is this thing that I'm eating? Like, is this from some beef I bought at Walmart where it's like a cow that was slaughtered on a huge factory farm and it's ground up cancerous tumor in the ground beef and that kind of thing? Is that really what you want to eat? Like, do you really want to taste that quarter pounder right now? knowing that kind of stuff is in it. maybe it is, you know, and I know I'm judgy when I say it the way, with the tone that I said it in. And I am judgy about it. But I don't intend harm. I just feel strongly that it's not healthy. And so maybe as you reflect on, as we can reflect on the things that we are considering eating, considering what it is one thing. And then if it sort of passes that first screening about, okay, what it is, that checks out. Like I can live with eating what that is. But then the next consideration is, why is that something we want to eat? Like, okay, you can live with it, or okay, you really want that. But why? Like, what's the thing that attracts you to it? And it's just considering, what is the reason I'm putting this into my body? Is it purely for taste? Is that enough of a reason to feel bloated or whatever, or to feel, you know, to have, to feel overly full or whatever you would feel? I mean, is taste the only thing that drives it, or are you considering some other things? So whatever, I'm just saying whatever works best on an individual level for the person. And I think that's what we could do. And the last thing, again, I want to loop back to this. And this was something that I've said a couple times in regards to Josh, but it's a communicating with him about this topic has really been a light bulb moment regarding being polite and debating with others. Now, Josh and I haven't debated yet. And I don't know that we're going to debate, because it just, we have this intention of not doing that. I don't think either of us really like it, first of all. And I think we just have this intention where we want to show up and celebrate the goodness of whatever path a person's on. So there's this real lesson in the whole thing about maintaining different views from people, but being able to discuss that politely. And even to get into a debate with someone where it's okay to be more assertive, maybe about your point of view, to maybe dig your heels in a little bit more than you usually care to do, but you're doing it just to present the clear things from your side or from your perspective. And you're kind of, basically, I think, trying to prove the virtue of your approach. I don't know why you would want to debate with somebody about it. But it's another lesson in that, because you can sit there and talk to someone who you know thinks differently than you, and you can just present what your view is without worrying about persuading that person. Like, they don't have to agree with you. And you can say it to them, and they don't have to agree with you. And you can say it to them in a very polite and cordial way, clear, and just say, well, I just see it this way, and et cetera, and so on. And that, and it's okay. They don't have to believe you. You're just looking to communicate and connect and be heard and seen and really build community is the way I see it. Anything other than that is a downward spiral. Like debates on Fox News comment area where people are just shaming each other and that they're just insulting each other back and forth. It's the whole thing. They just insult each other because they don't agree. It's pointless. And not only is it pointless, it's has, I think, a pretty significant negative impact. So, but anyway, thank you, Josh, for all the lessons. Thank you, everybody, for listening to this podcast episode. I feel like it was pretty long, but what can I say? I was getting into the segments, and I hope that you found something in it that you that sounded good to you. My name's Kevin Briggs, and I'm the creator of the Seeds of Liberation podcast, where every podcast episode has to do with something regarding being liberated from the things, from the roots of your suffering. And I'm no one special. I'm just a person doing the best I can to discuss these issues that are meaningful to me. And I've done some research and some reading on them, and maybe some practices, and gotten into some things because of this interest. But purely lay person, non-scientific practitioner approach. And these are just my musings. So hope you've heard something you liked. Really appreciate you listening, and to share it with your friends would be a wonderful thing too. Catch me next on Josh Crandall's Ethical Eater podcast, where we are going to talk about our divergent approaches to eating. And tune in for the next episode of the Seeds of Liberation podcast, during which I am going to read the entire Walt Whitman poem, Song of the Open Road. And then I'll do another episode after that, during which I will talk about each stanza, what I think is going on in it, and why it is still relevant for today, thus showing the relevance of poetry, which, like Bhante Premarattana would say, functions like it's its own, like a language. Thanks, everybody. Have a wonderful rest of your day or night.